I'm joined this morning by Dr. Valerie Ledwith from the Geography Discipline at NUI Galway to talk about her research around the area of population and migration. Good morning, Valerie. Would you like to begin by introducing yourself?
Good morning, Angela. Nice to be here. I, as you said, am in the Geography Department here at NUI Galway, and I'm the co-leader of the Population and Migration Research Network in the Whitaker Institute here at NUI Galway as well. My current research is in the subfield of geographies of education, and within that context, I focus particularly on migrant educational experiences here in Ireland.
So your work is in the subfield of geographies of education. Can you tell me a little bit more about that, please?
Since the early 2000s, there's been a more coherent engagement with educational issues within geographic research more broadly. And one of the key themes within this research is the issue of access. Access to schools, access to opportunities, and changing patterns of access locally and globally as a result of increased mobility. And that mobility has increased both in terms of family migration and labour migration, and also increased student mobility through internationalisation at the tertiary level. So geographies of education then, I suppose, has blossomed as a result of mobility in the context of education.
And how did you become interested in this kind of research?
I think my interest comes from a belief in the transformative power of a good education, first and foremost, and that every child deserves the opportunity to experience that. So when I lived in Los Angeles, I was amazed at the lengths that some migrant families went to get their children into a good school, busing them for over an hour on public transport to avoid bad schools, for example, living two or three families to an apartment or working two or three jobs so that they could live in a good school district. And I was also really, really shocked at how bad some schools were. No resources for materials, high teacher turnover, very high student failure rates. And then in the context of schools in Los Angeles, they were also very segregated socioeconomically, but also in terms of ethno-racial segregation. And these two things, sort of class differences and race differences, got mixed together and created a very toxic brew of educational inequality.
So I guess it's true to say that this real life experience informed your PhD research on school and neighbourhood segregation in Los Angeles.
It was eye-opening to see what the disparities in education were. And so when I got the opportunity to work with a large-scale data set from the RAND organization on school and neighborhood segregation in Los Angeles, I jumped at the opportunity. So it gave me the opportunity to examine the influence of socioeconomic and ethno-racial stratification on the educational experiences of children in Los Angeles. And in particular, because of the way that school attendance in Los Angeles was very specifically geographically demarcated, I could look at how the place in which a child lived interacted with race and class and their school experiences to influence their educational outcomes. So it was very valuable research.
And can you tell me about your key findings from that research?
Well, as expected, I suppose socioeconomic status was the key variable in determining scholastic achievement. But I think what was very important to me was the fact that this socioeconomic stratification overlapped in very complex ways with race and ethnicity. And so it was very difficult to consider one separate to the other. And another really important finding, and one that I brought forward with me back home to Ireland, was in relation to the issue of school choice and how school choice related to patterns of school and neighbourhood segregation, and also how school choice then impacted on scholastic achievement.
So your recent work in Ireland is also addressing school choice. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and your Irish experience?
Certainly. I returned to Ireland in 2006, and my aim was to conduct similar analysis here, given that Ireland at the time had gone through a fairly dramatic demographic transformation with a large influx of migration. So in terms of the potential for segregation, I thought that it was certainly a good time to think about perhaps doing some baseline analysis. However, it became very clear that education data in Ireland was not as readily available as it was in the United States. And so I had to take a step back and think about designing a survey myself. And so I did the Galway Education Survey. And when I worked with a colleague, Dr. Cathy O'Reilly, and we developed that survey with the primary goal being to enable analysis of the educational experiences of young migrants here. And so if we're to boil it down, the essence of that survey and the essence of the questions that the survey addresses are the three A's of education: access, achievement, and aspiration.
And school choice falls under the access portion.
That's right, yeah. Our results suggest some very important differences in relation to the kinds of schools that young people in Galway attend. So in particular, foreign-born children are much more likely to be enrolled in schools with vocational training options or schools that have disadvantaged status than their non-migrant peers. They're also much less likely, that is, migrant students are also much less likely to attend schools, first choice schools, or to travel beyond their closest school. And so this then suggests to me that access to secondary school is much more constrained for migrant families than non-migrant families.
So your research findings are showing that patterns of attendance are more constrained for migrant students.
That's true. But it's also important in terms of considering access to schools that we acknowledge the absence of attendance zones. So there isn't the same geographical demarcation as there was in Los Angeles, for example, or as there is in Wales or England. School attendance zones are not defined clearly. So in a sense, how this choice operates then here is quite different. What we found was that the difference in attendance patterns here in Ireland boiled down to whether or not somebody is local, and that preferences for local are built into the enrollment policies of the schools themselves.
Give me some examples.
For example, many secondary schools give preference to children from particular primary schools, what we call feeder schools. They may use parents as past pupil clauses in reaching enrollment decisions. And so many non-migrant students identified these kinds of family connections or attendance at a local feeder school as very natural or taken for granted in explaining why they attended the school that they were enrolled in. And their ease with explaining how they came to choose the school that they were in was in marked contrast to the experiences of migrant students and their families. So for migrant students, regardless of whether it was children of returned migrants, children of labour migrants, or a whole host of sort of categories in between, the common feature was that in the context of school choice, all migrants were not local. And that was the crux of the issue in terms of school choice, this not being local.
And this is problematic.
It is problematic because this kind of localism is quite exclusionary. And it's particularly problematic in communities that have experienced rapid demographic transitions associated with migration, and potentially then in areas where schools are already oversubscribed. So in these kinds of communities, then migrants, in a sense, become viewed as out of place, and they lack the appropriate level of ethnic and intergenerational capital that comes with Irish nationals' long-term residency. So in a sense, they haven't been around long enough to have the links to the local school to enable that choice to be non-problematic. And so the practices that structure who belongs in a school and who don't take, I suppose, reflect taken for granted exclusion. And it allows being local to become intertwined with a sense of citizenship defined very broadly, I suppose, in terms of belonging. And so it's problematic because it doesn't allow space to consider the asymmetric nature of power relations within communities, particularly in terms of disparities in access to resources, disparities in access to expertise, and differences in social capital.
And has the Department of Education and Skills addressed this issue?
It has. Most recently, the issue of school choice has been addressed by the Forum on Patronage and Pluralism. And there was a report put forward in 2012 in relation to that issue. That's at the primary level. And then previous to that, in 2011, the department published a discussion paper on a regulatory framework for school enrollment, which is more pertinent to the research associated with the Galway Education Survey.
Can you expand on that a little?
I can. In the foreword of that discussion paper, the Minister for Education at the time, Rory Quinn, acknowledged that the enrolment policies and practices that served schools and parents in the past were not now or couldn't fully accommodate the needs and diversity of our contemporary society. And so, as he saw it at the time, the challenge was striking a balance then between preserving aspects of tradition on the one hand and ensuring fairness on the other. However, I've argued fairly strongly that such statements are merely masquerading as a progressive discourse of inclusion and don't necessarily enable real inclusion on the ground.
Can you expand on that a little more, Valerie, please?
Well, in effect, such a statement sounds very good, but ultimately it allows the status quo to remain fundamentally unchallenged. The reality is that at the time of writing that discussion paper, there had been a 750% increase in appeals against refusals to enrol since 2002. So with statistics such as these, it would seem that maintaining the traditional system on the one hand and ensuring fairness for newcomers on the other are not mutually reachable.
Surely some of those appeals relate to situations where schools simply don't have the space.
That is the case in some instances. So about 60% of those appeals were related to a situation where the demand for places in the school concerned exceeded supply. But here's the nub of the issue. In those situations, the school adjudicates the applications on the basis of criteria in its admissions policy.
So who is in charge of admission policies?
That's a very good question. And I'm going to back up a little here just to put it in a broader context. The post-primary education sector is made up of secondary schools, vocational schools, community and comprehensive schools. So the secondary schools were set up by Catholic and Protestant religious orders ahead of state provision in the 19th century. Vocational schools were established later by the state and are administered now by the Education and Training Boards, which would be the former VECs. And then the community and comprehensive schools are often managed through partnerships between the ETBs and religious orders. So in 1998, the Education Act obliged the school patron to appoint a board of management. And this board of management has to be composed of teachers, parents, and members of the local community. And it's this board then that's responsible for publishing the school's admission policy. And it's accountable to the patron and not necessarily the parents or the community, but the actual patron of the school for upholding what's known as the characteristic spirit of that school.
What do you mean by characteristic spirit of the school?
Essentially, it's the ethos of the school, and it often reflects the denominational nature of the school in question.
And is there any legislation associated with admission policy?
There is. Section 19 of the Education Act in 2000 allows the board to refuse to admit a student where such a refusal is in accordance with the admission policy of the school concerned. So the school has the legal right to refuse a student. In addition, there's an exemption in the Equal Status Acts, which allows a school board of management to preferentially admit a student of a particular religious denomination and or to refuse to admit a student who is not of that religious denomination, provided it can prove the refusal is essential to maintaining the characteristic spirit or ethos of the school.
Are all secondary schools denominational?
They're not. Currently, denominational schools make up about 52% of all second level schools, but they cater for almost 60% of students. In addition to that, researchers at the ESRI recently highlighted that compared to other types of secondary schools, the denominational schools are much more likely to be oversubscribed. So therefore, religious patronage then has a very strong influence on admission policies, not only at primary level, but also at secondary level.
So what impact had the discussion paper on admission policies at the school level?
That's a good question. Ultimately, the discussion paper didn't challenge exclusion, religious or otherwise, within the regulatory framework of school enrolment. because it stopped short of calling for a change in the provisions of existing equality legislation. The current draft bill on admissions to schools also leaves those exemptions intact, although it has the potential to place a 10% cap on places reserved for the children of past pupils in Irish schools.
So the work on this issue is ongoing.
It is indeed. I am hopeful that the changes to legislation will tackle some of the issues relating to unequal access. However, I expect there will be a great deal of heated debate about the issue, both in the Oireachtas and at the school gate.
And are there any other issues of access that emerged from your research findings?
Indeed, there are. The ability to choose a school, of course, isn't the ultimate measure of access to education. There are a host of actions that can occur within the school itself that have dramatic impact on the educational experiences of students that are enrolled there. One practice that we found in our work was ability streaming, whereby students are assigned to a class based upon their academic ability, usually during the first year. And such practices can directly impact on whether a student sits an examination in junior cert at the higher ordinary or foundation level. And what we found was that migrant student groups were less likely than non-migrant students to take higher level subjects.
Is this because of language issues?
It's not because of language. We controlled for differences in language ability, we controlled for school effects and differences associated with gender. And so this disparity then is worrying because gaining access to high-level subjects at leaving cert level is dependent on having completed the subject at higher level for your junior cert. And then, of course, access to higher-level subjects at leaving cert impacts on the number of college entry points that a student can earn. So as such then, the junior certificate itself plays a very important role in determining post-secondary school access pathways. And for many young migrants, the exclusionary effects of early ability streaming will make transitioning to third level very difficult.
Valerie, you raised the issue of achievement in relation to university access. Did you find any disparities in achievement between migrant and non-migrant students?
We did. We actually systematically examined this issue. And to do so, we assigned points to each grade in each junior cert subject taken by a student, using the Leaving Cert point system as our guide. Then, using this score as the dependent variable, I then developed some predictive models of educational achievement. The first significant finding was that students attending DESH schools, or schools that have disadvantaged status, scored fewer points than those in other types of schools. And this was also the case for students attending schools with PLC or VITOS options available.
Why is that?
In relation to the DESH schools, the disadvantaged schools, there's evidence to suggest that schools with a greater than average proportion of socioeconomically disadvantaged students tend to have lower rates of educational achievement. In terms of the PLC schools, or those schools that have a more vocational ethos, it may be that the emphasis on a vocational ethos determines less academic pathways for the students that are enrolled there. However, at junior cert level, I think this perhaps is quite problematic. We're talking about students that are 14 or 15 years of age, already been streamed in a very specific direction that can have negative consequences on the suite of opportunities available to them after secondary school.
And were there any other important findings in relation to achievement?
In relation to achievement, it was interesting to note that access and school choice actually played a role. So students that were attending their first choice school had higher scores than those who attended other schools, so second choice or only schools that they could get into. The second key finding was that all groups of migrant children had significantly lower junior certificate scores than their non-migrant peers, even when we controlled for the effect of school type and language ability.
So does this achievement gap reflect different abilities between students?
It's not about ability, not at all. We tested for differences in ability across a range of subjects to see if non-migrant students were more or less likely to achieve a B grade or higher. And there was absolutely no significant differences in any of the subjects we tested between migrant students and their non-migrant peers. And so this really highlights, and it's a very important point, that it's not achievement disparities between migrants and non-migrants. It highlights that the achievement gap is the result of structural issues and not because the young students themselves are somehow less able.
What are the implications of these findings?
I suppose my greatest concern is that young migrants will not make the transition to third level education, even though they aspire to do so. And that's the third A in our research. Our work highlights that the majority of all young respondents plan to attend university. Over 70% of them, when asked, said that they planned to attend university. However, if they've been steered towards ordinary level papers at the junior certificate level, their potential at leaving certificate is incredibly curtailed. And by default, then, their ability to successfully transition to third level is completely undermined.
That has broader implications than their educational pathways.
Of course it does. Given the importance of the knowledge economy, whereby socioeconomic success depends upon acquiring knowledge and information for employment, the achievement gap is incredibly problematic. Indeed, it's possible that a broader sense of disaffection and alienation may emerge as future transitions and aspirations fail to materialise, and this will have knock-on consequences both for the education system and for society more broadly.
So where to from here, Valerie?
With this kind of work, it's all well and good to highlight the findings, but the real question is, what are you going to do with it? So one of the first things that we did, my colleague Cathy Riley and I, we fed our findings into the Galway County Integration and Diversity Strategy report and worked closely with Galway Rural Development Company and a countywide interagency strategy group, specifically on issues to do with education in the context of integration. And as a result of that work, we're involved with the education and training portion of the action plan for Galway County. Stemming from that, then, we set up a migrant forum here at NUI Galway as a place where migrant students who had successfully made the transition to university could network with each other and potentially feed information back into their communities to encourage and help other migrant students to make that transition to third level. And of course, research in this area is ongoing, and I continue to examine issues of access and equality in the education system more broadly than just at the secondary level. I'm starting a new project which is examining the relationship between patterns of primary school segregation, school choice, and the socio-demographic composition of parishes in Ireland. And I think that this work is incredibly important given the ongoing and continued demographic transitions that many communities in Ireland are experiencing.
Valerie, thank you very much and the very best of luck with your new project. If you'd like to find out more about Valerie's research, you can do so on the Whitaker website at whitakerinstitute.ie. Valerie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Angela. It's great to talk to you.